I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The teardown of all the tents and structure built for the NFL draft continues. There's a possibility that the draft could return to Philadelphia for another round of picks. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports the city's chief executive would sign off on a replay in an instant.
Mayor Jim Kenney says if the NFL wants to exercise this option for another NFL draft here next year, the city is willing to take on the massive event again.
It was a great event. I mean, if we're offered it, yes.
Kenney says fans were well behaved for the most part.
Everyone got along. Everyone had a good time. There were some good intention ribbing that went on back and forth, but everybody seemed to really enjoy each other's company, and it was a very family-friendly event. Lots of grandparents and grandkids and moms and dads, and everybody was being active and healthy and running the 40-yard dash and throwing footballs and kicking field goals, and it was just a wonderful event.
Philadelphia Eagles broadcaster Merrill Reese says he was impressed by the show and festival that went with the draft.
Oh, I thought it was electric. The crowd was so into it. They showed that this is one of the most passionate fan bases in the entire country. They love NFL football. They were excited to have the draft here. And I thought it was just an enormously successful event.
SEPTA reports ridership on the subways was up 7% from April 27th through the 29th, compared to the same days the year before when it was just the Penn Relays taking place. And if the people in the neighborhoods around the parkway who referred to it as NFL hell through the process thought this was the end, it's not going to be better anytime soon. Jay-Z's announced he'll be the headliner for the Made in America concert for Labor Day weekend. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
While hundreds of thousands gathered on the parkway this weekend to take in the draft, we headed to a quiet subdivision in Blackwood, New Jersey. There, friends and family gathered with Julian Davenport, a massive offensive tackle with big pro potential. Davenport was hoping to become the first player from Bucknell University in central Pennsylvania to be drafted in almost 50 years. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt was there to watch his draft day experience play out.
It starts with a quintessentially suburban scene. A muggy Friday afternoon, a dad out by his shed, the sounds of a hammer blended against the yapping of neighborhood dogs. After 10 hours preparing the backyard for what could be the biggest night of his son's life, Anthony Davenport nails in the final touch. It's a poster with pictures of Julian layered under an image of the NFL shield. About 25 feet away, a projector casts the NFL draft onto a massive screen.
The second round is now officially open.
On Friday night, the NFL held the second and third rounds of its amateur draft. Julian Davenport and about 50 others are here to watch it all unfold. They hope he'll be picked tonight. If not, they'll hold their breath and do it all again Saturday.
How do you feel right now?
Excited. Anxious. Pick an emotion, I'm sure it's there.
It is soon apparent that there are two types of parties here. Julian's stepmom, Tanya Davenport, is among a handful of folks tracking every single pick. Since Julian is an offensive tackle, they're waiting for other offensive tackles to be drafted so that the supply of available players goes down.
Get him out the way. He's out the way now. Let's go.
While some can't look away, others are finding it hard to watch. In the kitchen, those seeking distraction can find Tanya's mom, Maddie Mallory, dishing out shots of moonshine mixed with lemonade.
All right, that's all you need. It'll hit you later, though. All right, good.
Yeah, I was told to come get a shot of moonshine.
I'm not responsible.
Through all of this, Julian sits right near the screen, barely talking, cradling his smartphone in his left hand. The phone doesn't ring. And as the weather chills, so does the mood. Julian Davenport will not be picked today.
Thanks for joining us this evening. Hope to see you tomorrow. Round 4 through 7 begins at 12 noon.
As Saturday begins, I find his father, Anthony Davenport, seated in the garage, scrolling through his phone.
Arizona, Cincinnati, Chicago, Eagles at 18.
He's looking at the draft order, trying to figure out when Julian might go. A phone call Friday would have been nice, but a phone call today is an absolute must, and the mood reflects it. Stepmom Tanya keeps herself busy preparing chicken.
It's tough. It's definitely tough, and you're processing it. You know, you're worried, and yep, that's why I keep cooking.
Julian arrives late, and when he does, he seems restless. instead of parking near the big TV like Friday, he moves from room to room as if trying to avoid the crowds that inevitably tail him. The tension builds for about an hour, and then, from inside the house, a stir.
Houston?
See, players don't find out they've been drafted by actually watching TV. They get a phone call just beforehand. Shortly after 1 p.m., that call comes in, and word spreads quickly among the party guests.
Was it Houston?
Soon, everyone rushes around a TV just off the kitchen.
Houston, we have a draft pick. Pick in the 2017 NFL Draft, the Houston Texans select Julian
As the crowd erupts, Julian barely moves. He's a quiet guy, the type for whom a quick smile counts as an outburst. When Julian got the call, he was by himself in the back corner of his basement, playing video games.
Just sitting there playing the game. I was just hanging around.
When his phone began to ring, he didn't pick it up because he didn't want to be found.
Another one of my friends, I guess, was looking for me upstairs, so he was FaceTiming me as I was down here, and like I just wasn't answering. Then the phone rang again, and I'm like, why does he keep FaceTiming me? And I look, and it's not him. I see it's a Houston Texan number.
You assume going into an event like this what the high notes will look like, but fate has a way of finding those who don't expect it. For Julian's mom, Leslie Schaul, that unguarded moment arrived one morning last week as she drove to her job as an elementary school teacher.
I was driving in my car and listening to my gospel music.
And as she barreled down the 42 freeway, she started to cry. She thought about her four children, beautiful and healthy. Children she raised when she was a teacher's assistant, making $896 every 2 weeks.
I guess they said God has a plan for you, and I put my faith and trust in him all the time. And my faith and trust is paying off.
To the shadows, shadows come.
The song on the radio was an old gospel tune, His Eye Is on the Sparrow. It says that God watches over everything, even the smallest birds. And if God can watch over the sparrow, surely he can look after Julian Davenport, offensive lineman for the Houston Texans. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Covering Congress and the White House is a busy gig these days, but it's one reporter Robert Costa has embraced. And last month, Costa picked up an additional gig, becoming the host of the venerable reporter roundtable show Washington Week, airing on WHYY TV 12 Friday nights at 8. Robert Costa joins me now. Robert, I know you're pretty busy, so thanks for taking the time.
Great to join you. Thank you.
You grew up in Yardley, right outside of Philadelphia. And I've heard you say this region, with its rich connection to American history, is one of the reasons you got into reporting. Did I get that right?
Oh, it certainly is. I grew up in Yardley in Lower Bucks County, spent all my time growing up coming to Philadelphia to see the Art Museum, Independence Hall, going to the 700 level at Veterans Stadium, Phillies games, Eagles games, went to a big public school, Pensbury High School. And I always loved, you know, being just a mile away from Washington's Crossing, and you couldn't help but almost fall in love with history by growing up in the Philadelphia area.
I don't need to tell you, you're taking the reins of a program with a rich history. You're the eighth host of Washington Week, which began 50 years ago. And we should probably talk for a moment about your predecessor, the late Gwen Ifill. You did fill in as host of the show while Gwen was alive. How well did you know each other, and what lessons did you take from her in terms of hosting the show?
Well, Gwen is so dearly missed, and in particular by me as the new moderator, but as someone who knew her well. She was a friend. She was a mentor. She was someone who was so kind, and she was smart, whip smart, friendly to younger journalists. She gave me a shot back in 2014 to start coming on Washington Week, which to me then and now was this venerable show. It had been on since 1967. It had been hosted for 20 years by Paul Duke. Some people may remember him, this old presence of what Washington was in my mind, of grizzled reporters and talking through things, just the facts. And Gwen had all that in her in terms of that old school reporting persona, but she was someone who was very welcoming. And it's just so sad that she's gone. But my whole goal is, as moderator, just to try to continue her legacy, to stick to reporting and have a conversation that's lively and illuminating.
So you're keeping your day job. You're still doing political reporting for the Washington Post. After spending a week in the weeds of politics, Do you find that you learn anything in these sort of big picture conversations that you get to have on Washington Week?
I do. That's why I was really happy to have the opportunity, because I didn't want to give up being a daily reporter. I love being on Capitol Hill, being at the White House, trying to figure out what's really going on, having that first row seat to history. And I don't like the idea of sitting back in a studio all week thinking about TV. That's just not who I am. But Friday night, to have other reporters who are not only people I know, but people who are rivals competing for scoops, to have them sit around the table, put our notebooks up, and for 30 minutes to have some of the top reporters in the country say, let's actually have a conversation. No pundits, no strategists like you see all over cable. I'm not against that. There's a place for that. But it's also okay to have one table once a week where it's only reporters, and it's people who are more print-focused sometimes or all reporting-focused if they're TV correspondents. And just have a conversation. And then there's a value to that that's almost intangible. It's hard to explain, because I think reporters so often feel like we're being boxed in to these TV boxes or different dynamics that aren't really our forte.
We're now through 100 days of the Trump administration. Do you have a particular moment or anecdote that you think was illuminating or surprising, or you know, something that you just never really expected to happen that's indicative of kind of where we are now?
Sure. I think the time that sticks out to me was when President Trump called me on my cell phone. Was something I was not expecting, as the healthcare bill fell apart, and he said, "Bob, the bill's pulled. I'm pulling the bill." And we had a conversation for about 20 minutes about how disappointed he was with the Republican-controlled Congress, how so many factions in Washington had stymied him at the start of his presidency. And it was fascinating and intriguing to hear the President of the United States, someone I've covered deeply for a long time, had many interviews with, to have him as president in an almost candid, casual way walk through how Washington was confronting him, how he as this outsider was dealing with a bracing political reality that he couldn't actually do everything he wanted to do. And he did it in a phone call with a reporter. And to me, that was just a moment where I saw Trump himself is still adjusting as much as Washington's adjusting to Trump, more than some people who are Washington types.
Robert Costa is the new host of Washington Week on PBS. He covers Congress and the White House for the Washington Post. Robert Costa, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
This past weekend, President Donald Trump held a rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to mark his first 100 days in office. As part of our occasional series, I Voted Trump, Keystone Crossroads reporter Lindsay Lazarsky checks in with Trump voters across the state to see whether their views have changed.
Daphne Goggins is a mother, grandmother, community activist, and an avid social media user. She often posts updates about President Donald Trump to her followers.
Hashtag that's my president.
In many ways, Goggins represents a typical Trump supporter and views the president as a brilliant businessman. She doesn't care that he hasn't released his tax returns and believes the media scrutiny of President Trump has been unfair.
There's no other way to describe it except dynamic.
But as a black Republican in North Philadelphia, there aren't many Trump supporters in her neighborhood. During the campaign, when she hung a Trump-Pence sign on her front porch, the next day it was gone. But Goggins didn't worry. She had dozens more to replace it. When we asked her what's changed during the first 100 days, Goggins told us people in her community had become more receptive to her message about Trump.
I know what's changed. The atmosphere. When I go places and I see people, I'm not getting that, oh, you Donald Trump, I'm not getting that. A lot of people are coming up to me saying, I hear you. You know, that's what's up. And you know what I tell them? You got a 401k? Look at it. You know what I'm saying? Those are the things that really matter.
How the economy is doing is one of the top concerns for Trump supporters across the state. Phil and Marion Spotts live in Waterford near Erie. Phil had worked in the insurance industry and Marion was a registered nurse. Even though they're both retired, they still have their hands in a few small businesses, including a construction company and a pick-your-own raspberry farm. They've been keeping up with the Trump administration, and here's Phil's take.
Well, I thought he was going to do a lot better than what he's doing, than the results are. And I don't know what to attribute that to, except for the fact that he might have had a rather robust agenda and that it was going to be difficult to achieve all that in 100 days. And he's probably taken a bigger bite than what he can chew.
Seth Coffer, a doctor and a Republican ward leader in South Philadelphia, was disappointed that the president's healthcare agenda fizzled. Despite the failure of the Republicans' healthcare bill, Coffer is still hopeful his party will come up with a better solution.
I am a little upset about the healthcare situation we're in right now. So many of my patients, so many doctors I know, so many people are still suffering with poor healthcare in our country, and that's really one of the things we need to improve.
Repealing Obamacare was also high on the list of priorities for Jessica Turpak. She's a small business owner in Schuylkill County, and she's been a diehard Trump supporter from the start. So much so that she dressed her youngest son, Hunter, as baby Trump during one of his rallies in Wilkes-Barre. Trump took Hunter into his arms and onto the stage.
Wow!
Did I expect years and years of work to get done in 100 days? Absolutely not. However, I feel like every time I turn on the TV and see what we're doing and where he's at, I think, you know what, he's on the right track.
For Turpak, part of that right track is Trump bringing on his daughter Ivanka Trump and son-in-law Jared Kushner as close advisors.
When he took my son up on stage, his demeanor towards the little guy, it kind of showed like a family guy, you know, a grandfather, a father. And that's what I see when he brought him in. I mean, he didn't bring in somebody he just met through the campaign or somebody he was introduced to. So I feel like, you know, it kind of speaks of how family-oriented he is.
But not all Trump voters are as passionate about the president.
Emotionally, I'm not happy with the man.
That's Penny Stanger. She and her husband Tom live in Pittsburgh. Originally, the Stangers supported Bernie Sanders. But when Election Day rolled around, Tom voted for Hillary Clinton and Penny voted for Trump. She's Catholic, pro-life, and she says she regrets voting for Trump.
He's not invested with politicians and he's not working with people. We're working with the politicians to come to compromise, to make things happen. He just kind of says, this is the way it's going to go. And his team, oh my goodness, they're not qualified, a lot of them. I don't know why he chose them, except they have to be yes people.
In Altoona, one of Pennsylvania's distressed cities, Republican Mayor Matt Pacifico says not much has changed since Trump took office. Pacifico voted for Trump in hopes that he would fulfill his campaign promise of bringing jobs back to the region. But with the release of the president's initial budget and a threat to community development block grant funding, Pacifico's worried.
We're already taking steps to kind of reach out to our U.S. senators and congressmen and letting them know that, you know, that's something that Altoona relies on, you know, not just for helping with housing projects and stuff like that and rehabilitations. But with doing streetscape projects and paving roads in those low to moderate income areas, you know. So there's a lot that we do with that money, and so it would be a shame to see that go away.
And as a first-time politician, Pacifico's advice for President Trump hasn't changed.
Grow thicker skin and stay off Twitter.
Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
The 1st of May officially marks May Day. This week, Newsworks Tonight hosts Dave Heller and Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, talk about spring celebrations connected to the stars.
Derek, what's the significance of May Day?
Today, the first day of May is recognized by some cultures as a way to celebrate the coming of spring. In older times, it was considered to be the first day of summer in some European countries.
First day of summer?
Yes, so first day of summer.
Did they line all the seasons up accordingly?
Not quite. Why? February 1st was seen as the first day of spring, June 21st as midsummer, and if we actually look at Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, that occurs on June 21st, so that would help us understand how midsummer fits into this, with the understanding that spring starts much earlier in those countries. Now, you'll recognize that these are all cultural celebrations and have nothing to do with the position of the Earth around the sun.
Interesting, then, that Cinco de Mayo is also a date of astronomical significance.
Well, yes, but that Cinco de Mayo is not necessarily the same celebration as the one that we would have coming up this Friday. This would be the 56th anniversary of Alan Shepard's flight into space as the first American astronaut. Now, before we misunderstand, this was not an orbital mission. It was a suborbital mission, a ballistic mission, if you will, in which he flew up into space, 62 miles or so up, and then came back down in a 15-minute flight.
What's old is new again. Isn't that the kind of trip that's going to first be offered to regular citizens who want to experience that kind of a thing?
Well, yes, that's true, but their flights will last a little bit longer than that 15 minutes. And, of course, they won't have anywhere near the kinds of tasks and chores or anxiety or concerns that were had back at that time when this first flight was done. However, the significance of this was dimmed to a degree because of the fact that Yuri Gagarin had actually flown one orbit around the Earth as the first human from the Soviet Union just 3 weeks earlier. So at this point, America was behind the eight ball in terms of the space race.
From this vantage point, why is it then that John Glenn's name has more renown than either Shepard or Gagarin?
The reason why Glenn is so universally recognized is because he was the first American to orbit the Earth. He did three orbits. And what that did was that really brought America fully into the space race as a real contender. John Glenn also had the personality and the presence that was being looked for at that time as that image of what an American astronaut should be.
By contrast, Neil Armstrong had the presence, but not that personality.
By the time Armstrong came along, he'd had much more training than the original seven astronauts had, and also had a better sort of view of what his missions would be. But he didn't have the kind of relationship with the media that Glenn and the original seven astronauts had. It wasn't that he didn't like the press, but that he was just a much more private person and felt like his accomplishments should speak for him more than him speaking himself.
And they sure did.
And they certainly did. In fact, it was 51 years ago this Saturday that Neil Armstrong ejected safely from what was then called the Flying Bedstead. And this was the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle. It was a training platform, really, for him to learn how to fly what was going to become the lunar lander. But this was a large, ungainly piece of steel contraption that had two jet engines on it that he was trying to maneuver into a landing position. Let's say the craft got away from him, and he successfully ejected from it while he was training for his upcoming lunar landing mission.
I'm going to check and see if bedstead sales plummeted after that.
They certainly should have.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by me, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for NewsWorks Tonight.